Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Nutmeg of Consolation by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull.
Chapter 1. 157 castaways on a desert island in the South China Sea. The survivors of the wreck of HMS Diane, which had struck upon an uncharted rock and had there been shattered by a great typhoon some days later. 157. But as they sat there round the edge of a flat, bare piece of ground between high water mark and the beginning of the forest, they sounded like the full complement of a ship of the line, for this was Sunday afternoon, and the starboard watch, headed by Captain Aubrey, was engaged in a cricket match against the Marines under their commanding officer, Mr. Welby. It was a keenly contested match, and one that aroused the strongest passions, so that roaring, hooting, cheers and catcalls followed almost every stroke. And to an impartial observer, it was yet another example of the seaman's power of living intensely in the present, with little or no regard for futurity. A feckless attitude, but one combined with uncommon fortitude, since the atmosphere was as wet as a living sponge, and from behind its clouds the sun was sending down a most oppressive heat. The only impartial observer at hand was Stephen Maturin, the ship's surgeon, who thought cricket the most tedious occupation known to man, and who was now slowly climbing away from it through the forests that covered the island, with the intention first of killing a boar, or in default of a boar some of the much less popular ring-tailed apes, and then of reaching the north side where the bird's nest soup swallows nested. On the rounded top of a knoll where the boar track led inland, he paused and looked down on the southern shore. Well out to sea on his left hand, the reef on which the frigate had struck, now white with the broken water of a neap at three-quarter ebb, but then invisible beneath the spring-tide flood. Far to his right, the point where a large piece of the wreck had come ashore. Left again to the scoured-out inlet to which the wreckage had been towed by the one remaining boat, carefully prized apart and reassembled in the present elegant ribbed skeleton of the schooner that was to carry them to Batavia as soon as it was planked, decked and rigged. Well up the slope from this inlet, the camp under the lee of the forest in which they'd sheltered from the typhoon that destroyed the stranded frigate, drowned many of her people, almost all her livestock and almost all her powder, and then immediately below him the broad expanse, firm and level, where the white-clad figures flitted to and fro. White-clad not so much because this was cricket as because it was Sunday, with mustering by divisions, necessarily shaved and in a clean shirt, followed by church. It might seem the very height of levity to be playing cricket with the schooner far from finished, with stores very low and with the little island's resources in coconuts, boars and ring-tailed apes nearly exhausted. Yet Stephen knew very well what was in Jack Aubrey's mind. The people had behaved extremely well so far, working double tides. But they were not a crew made up solely of man-o'-war's men bred to the service and serving together for years at a time. At least a third had been pressed into the Navy. There were several recent drafts, and there were some King's hard bargains, including two or three sea lawyers. Yet even if they'd all been seamen, serving in the Navy since the beginning of the war, some relaxation was essential. And they'd been looking forward to this match with the liveliest anticipation. The camphor wood or palm-ribbed bats lacked some of the elegance of willow, but the sailmaker had sewed a wholly professional ball, using leather that could be spared from gaff jaws, and the players had swayed away on all top ropes to do their service credit. Furthermore, cricket formed some small part of that penny glass of ceremony which upheld the precious spirit. Not indeed to be compared to the high rituals aboard, such as divisions and the solemn reading of the Articles of War, to say nothing of burials and rigging church, but by no means inconsiderable as a way of imposing order upon chaos. What Stephen didn't fully appreciate was the degree of pleasure that Jack took in this particular ceremony. As a captain, Aubrey was exceedingly worried by the shortage of food and marine stores, particularly cordage, by the near absence of powder, and by the coming total absence of arrack and tobacco. But as a cricketer, he knew that close concentration was necessary on any pitch, above all on one like this, which more nearly resembled a stretch of white concrete than any Christian meadow. And when he came in second wicket down, the yeoman of the sheets having been bowled by the sergeant of the marines for a creditable 16, he took centre and looked about him with an eager, piercing, predatory eye, tapping the blockhole with his bat, wholly taken up with the matter in hand. "Play!" cried the sergeant. He took two little skips and bowled a twisting lob, pitched well up. "Never mind manoeuvres," Nelson had said, "always go at them." Jack obeyed his hero, leapt out, caught the ball before it landed and drove it straight at the bowler's head. The grim sergeant neither flinched nor ducked, but seized it as it flew. "Out!" cried Edwards, the only civilian aboard and therefore a perfect umpire. "Out, sir, I'm afraid." Amid the roaring of the soldiers and the universal moan of disappointment from the seamen, for the captain was well liked, both as an officer and as a dashing bat once his eye was in, Jack said, "Well held, sergeant," and walked off to the three coconut palms, long since bare of fruit, that served them as a pavilion. "Let it not be an omen," said Stephen, slinging his rifle and turning away. It was an exceptionally fine rifle, a breech-loading Joe Manton, and he'd inherited it from Mr. Fox, the British envoy they had brought out in the Dian to counteract the French negotiations with the Sultan of Pulo Prabang. Fox had succeeded. He'd obtained a treaty of mutual assistance. But in his eagerness to carry it home, he'd set off to sail the 200 miles to Batavia in the ship's stout and well-manned pinnace, while the Dian was lying quietly on her reef, neaped, immovable until the next spring tide, and had been destroyed by the typhoon that destroyed the frigate. A very fine rifle. Stephen was a deadly shot, and since there was so very little powder, far too little for a general blazing away with muskets, he was the camp's chief hunter. This was a relief for everybody. During the first fortnight, he'd worn himself raw, pulling on ropes, helping to saw wood, beating home tree nails and wedges, and he'd suffered much from the inherent malignity of things. No rope pulled over the most innocent surface that didn't succeed in twisting upon itself, or catching in some minute anfractuosity or protrusion. No saw that didn't deviate from its line. No mallet that didn't strike his already bruised and purple-swollen hand. But his companions had suffered even more from having to retie all his knots and rescue him from improbable dangers, perpetually keeping one eye on the doctor and one on their work. Even when put to dig out the choked well, the softest job in hand, he'd contrived to send a pick through William Gorge's foot. Yet as a hunter for the pot, he was of great value to the crew. Not only was he thoroughly at home with the weapon, but he was an experienced field naturalist, long accustomed to following a track, to the silent, upwind approach, and to indefinite, motionless waiting. These were necessary qualifications, because although he had two kinds of swine, the bearded pig and the Babarusa, they had both been hunted at some not very remote period, and from the beginning they'd been wary. Now the survivors were not only warier by far, but they were also very much thinner on the ground. And whereas in the first week he'd been able to provide all hands with twice the ship's ordinary allowance of pork in an evening's stroll, now he had to sweat over the whole island, sometimes for quite a small creature, sometimes, indeed, missing even that, his damaged powder fizzling in the breach. The trail he was following at present, however, was more promising than any he'd seen for some while. It was recent. So recent that when it reached the edge of a spiny rattan patch, he saw the outer rim of the deep hoof print fall in. What's more, this animal was almost certainly a Babarusa of 9 or 10 score, the first he'd seen since Thursday week. He was glad of it, because the ship's company included several Jews and many Mahometans, united only in their hatred of swine's flesh. But a willing mind could accept the Babarusa, with his extraordinary horn-like upper pair of tusks and his long legs, as the kind of deer that might be expected on so remote an island. "I shall go round and wait for him," said Stephen. And he fetched a long cast round the rattan brake, walking slowly in the heat. The animal had almost certainly gone to sleep. The boars of this country, like all the other boars he'd ever known, were deeply conservative, devoted to the beaten track, and by now he knew most of their paths. At the other end of this one he climbed a tree that commanded the way out of the brake, and in its broad, mossy crutch he sat at his ease, embowered in orchids, of a species, a habit and colour he'd never seen before. The low sun appeared through a gap in the clouds, sinking towards Sumatra, Biliton, the west in any case, and sloping under the canopy had lit the orchid, the whole spray of 50 or 60 orchid flowers with singular brilliance, vermilion in the wet, shining green. He was still contemplating it and its attendant insects when the boar began moving again in the rattan brake. The sound came nearer. The boar emerged, standing motionless, its square snout twitching from side to side. With a detached, clinical look on his face, Stephen dropped it dead and climbed down from the tree. He had an apron in his knapsack, and he put it on to Gralloch his pig, because although he had no objection to a little blood on his clothes, Killick had. And Killick's high, nasal, complaining, righteous voice going on was so disagreeable that the inconvenience of an apron on so heavy a day was nothing to it. He also had a light tackle that allowed him to heave the beast about single-handed. This was the one piece of something like seamanship that he'd studied with profit. Bomden, the captain's coxswain, had spent hours showing him how to make one end fast and how to reeve the fall through the channels. And as long as he held the top block uppermost, he often succeeded at the first try. He succeeded now. And stepping back, he surveyed the boar with real satisfaction. Nearer 11 score than 10, and there were few dishes Jack Aubrey preferred to soused pig's face, while for his own part he was fond of a pair of cold crubeens. He hung his apron on a branch to guide those who would carry the Babarusa down and wiped his hands on his jacket. On his jacket, as he realised a moment too late, gazing at the stain on the fine white linen. "I shall try to get it off at the Swallow's Pool," he said, but with no conviction. At one period in his childhood he'd been under the rule of a Dominican tertiary called Sor Luisa, one of the older, more respectable branch of the Torquemadas of Valladolid. His cousin and godfather was very particular about these things. A woman for whom cleanliness, was godliness. And his attempts at getting it off had never deceived her for a moment. Now she had been replaced by a lean, ageless, weather-beaten, pigtailed seaman with one gold earring and a shrewish, penetrating voice. It wasn't even that Killick was his servant with a servant's rights. He was Jack Aubrey's steward, Stephen's man being a gentle, witless young Malay by the name of Ahmed. But preserved Killick had known both the captain and the doctor so long and acquired such a moral ascendancy in certain fields that Ahmed was no protection at all. As Stephen had feared, the swallow's pool did nothing to remove the stain. But with a cowardice unworthy of his age and education, he concealed the blood and peritoneal fluid with a superimposed film of dirt from the water's edge, adding some algae for good measure. He called the pool the Swallows because it was near the bird's most spectacular cliff, not because they used the soft grey mud for building. Far from it, indeed. The wholly sheltered nests were pearly white and translucent, with never a hint of moss or vegetable fibre, far less of mud. These were the nests deepest in the caves, or rather clefts, in the seaward precipice, and Stephen could see the best only from one place where his particular cave soared up from a broad, deep stretch of shingle 200 feet below to a narrow fissure at the top. He had an indifferent head for heights, and the upper yards of even a frigate filled him with paralysing dread, scarcely to be overcome by the strongest effort of will. But here he could lie flat, with his arms and legs spread out, his body firmly pressed against the warm, level rock, and only his face hanging over the void, gazing at the birds below. The cloud of little grey birds that flew in at the widest part of the cave whirled about at an extraordinary speed, and then shot off from the general vortex, each to its own nest. He leant farther into the cavity, his hands spread to shade his eyes, and almost at once his wig fell off, turning and turning until it vanished among the bird-filled shadows far below. "Hell and death," he said. For although it was only an old scratch wig worn almost bare, Killick had recently curled and whitened its sides. There was nothing to be done to the top. And in any case, he felt naked without it. The vexation lasted little longer than the slow, turning fall, however. His wild attempt at catching the wig had brought him into a much better position. Certainly it meant that the sun shone right onto the back of his unprotected head, but it allowed him to lie there in the utmost comfort, his face far deeper into the cleft. His body was perfectly relaxed, and as his eyes grew even more used to the dimness of the cavern, he could make out the nests themselves, stretching away and away in rows, half-cups touching one another row upon row, covering the rock wall from 60 feet above high water mark almost all the way up. The finest and whitest being not the top rows, which had a certain amount of wind-drifted dirt upon them, but those about 20 down in a narrow chimney. These were the nests that were sold for their weight in silver among the Chinese. And, as he'd expected, the nestlings, the scrupulously clean nestlings, two to each brood, would be ready to fly any day now. Yet as he lay there, glass after glass, oblivious of the roasting sun, and watching the whirl of parent birds bringing food and carrying away fecal sacks, a frown came over his face. He concentrated all his attention upon one particularly well-lit nest, and slowly his suspicions were confirmed. Again and again, the incoming bird perched on its rim with all four toes pointing forward. After another half hour, he rose to his feet, shouldered his rifle, and looking back at the birds with real displeasure, he walked off. "They're not swallows at all," he said, feeling not only indignant but deadly sick. He stepped aside into a bush, and then into a series of bushes, for the vomiting was succeeded by an imperative looseness. Stephen Maturin wasn't really an ill-natured man, but his was scarcely a jovial, sunny temperament, and sometimes disturbances of this kind rendered him morose or even worse. By the time he reached the camp, he was perfectly ready to savage Killick. Killick knew him very well, however, and after one glance at his filthy jacket, his indecently bare head and the dangerous look in his pale eye, silently fetched him a broad-brimmed Senate hat and said, "Captain's just woke up, sir." "My indignation against those birds was quite excessive," said Stephen inwardly. "'Twas no doubt caused by a sudden flow of bile. My posture exerting pressure on the ductus colidocus communis." He stepped into the dispensary, mixed himself a draught, lay flat on his back for a while, and then walked towards the tent, feeling somewhat better. He repeated, "Quite excessive." Yet even so, having received Jack's congratulations on the Barbarossa, "I'm so glad. I was getting sick of those damned apes, even made into pasties," he said. "As for those bird's nest soup creatures, I'm afraid I must tell you they are not true swallows at all, but only a dwarvish branch of the Oriental swifts." "Never be so put about, brother," said Jack. "What's in a name? So long as they make the right well-tasting kind of nest, it would be all one. If they were called ostriches. Did you like them at the Raffers?" "I thought they made a capital dish. It was a very pleasant evening altogether." "Then perhaps we might take some in a few days' time. This is the season. The young are almost on the wing, and a little small thin midshipman like Reed or Harper could be lowered down the cleft on a rope and collect half a dozen empty nests. And I must say I should like to net one or two of the birds to examine their toes. But come, I've not asked you how the match went. Did we win?" "I'm happy to say we all won. It was a draw. They made more runs than we did, but they couldn't manage to get Fielding and the bosun out before stumps were drawn. Fortunately, we had Edwards as a neutral timekeeper, so there were no wry looks, no murmurs about flogging the glass, and we all triumphed. Certainly everyone looked very cheerful as I came through the camp, though the dear knows it must have been a wearing form of sport in its breathless heat. Even pacing slowly under the trees, I was all aswim, to say nothing of running about after a hard and wicked ball in the sultry glare, God forbid. Yet I'm sure all hands will turn to the better for it tomorrow. I'm sure I shall. And from the look of the sky, we shall have an east wind. I hope so, indeed. There's a great deal of long sawing to be done. Exhausting work, even with a breeze to take away the dust and let the bottom sawyer breathe. But once we start planking her, it'll encourage the people amazingly, and we may be able to put to sea before St. Famine's Day. Come down to the slip, and I'll show you what remains to be done." The camp, with its ditch and earthwork trim again after the typhoon, was laid out after the fashion of a man-of-war. And to avoid disturbing the foremast hands who were sitting about talking outside their tents at the farther end of the rectangle, Jack stepped onto the carriage of the brass 9-pounder dominating the seaward approach and jumped over, giving Stephen a hand. It was a fine gun, one of the much-loved pair that had gone overboard with the rest when they were lightening ship in an attempt at heaving her off the reef, and the only one to be found wedged between the rocks at low tide by a fishing party. A very fine gun, but of less use than the two light carronades, even if there'd been quantities of powder, because the single round shot that was still in place when it was recovered was the only 9-pound ball they possessed. "Sir! Sir!" called Captain Aubrey's two remaining lieutenants, gasping up the hill towards him. "The midshipmen have caught a turtle out by the point."
"Is it a true turtle, Mr. Fielding?"
"Well, sir, I trust it is, I'm sure. But Richardson thinks it looks a little strange, and we hope the doctor would tell us if it could be ate." They went sloping right-handed down the valley, skirting the mass of rock and earth which had slid down the hillside at the height of the typhoon. a mass in which some trees and bushes were still growing happily, others withering as they stood. Across the dry bed of the watercourse the torrent had scooped out, providing them with a commodious building slip, and out along the strand almost to the place where the precious wreck had come ashore. The whole midshipman's berth was there, all standing silent in the roar of the surf. Two master's mates, the one midshipman proper, the other had been drowned, the two youngsters, the captain's clerk and the assistant surgeon. Like the other officers, they'd changed out of their fine Sunday clothes. They were now in ragged trousers or breeches undone at the knees. Some had no shirts to their nut-brown backs. No shoes, of course. A poverty-stricken, hungry group, though cheerful. "Should you like to see my Tesla, sir?" cried Reed from 100 yards or more. His voice hadn't yet broken, and it carried high above the sea's growl and thunder. "Your turtle, Mr. Reed?" asked Jack, coming nearer. "Oh, yes, sir, I saw him first." In the captain's presence, Seymour and Bennett, the tall young master's mates who had turned the turtle, could do no more than exchange a look. But Reed, observing it, added, "Of course, the others helped a little." They gazed for a while at the pitiful flippers swimming powerfully in the air. "What do you think's wrong with the turtle, Mr. Richardson?" asked Jack again.
"I can hardly put my finger on it, sir," said Richardson, "but there's something about his mouth I don't quite like."
"The doctor'll set us all right," said Jack, raising his voice over a triple crash of breakers. The ebb was well underway, and the riptide, combined with the current, was cutting the steady swell off the point into a series of chaotic cross seas.
"He's the green turtle, sure," said Stephen, equally loud in spite of his aching head, but in quite a different pitch, higher, disagreeably metallic. "And a very fine green turtle, 200 weight, I should say. But he's a male, and of course his face is displeasing. He would be rejected on the London market. He would never do for an alderman."
"But is he edible, sir? Can he be et? He ain't unwholesome. He's not like the soft purple fish you made us throw away."
"Oh, he may be a little coarse, but he'll do you no harm. If you have any doubts, and heaven knows I'm not infallible, you may desire Mr. Reed to eat some first, and then watch him for a few hours. But in any event, I do beg you'll take the animal's head off directly. I hate seeing them strive and suffer. I remember one ship where they had scores made fast on deck, and the creature's eyes were red as cherries, unwatered by the sea. A friend and I went round sponging them." Reed and Harper ran up to the camp for the carpenter's broad axe. Aubrey and Maturin walked back along the hard-beaten sand to the building slip.
"That is a very horrid tide race," observed Jack, nodding out to sea. And then,
"Do you know, I very nearly said a good thing just now about your cock and hen turtles. It was on the lines of sauce. Sauce for the goose being sauce for the gander, you understand. But it wouldn't quite take shape."
"Perhaps, my dear, it was just as well. A facetious lieutenant is good company if he happens to be endowed with wit. A facetious commander among his equals, perhaps. But may not the post-captain who sets the quarter-deck in a roar conceivably lose some of his Jovian authority?
Did Nelson crack jokes at all?"
"I never heard him, to be sure. He was nearly always cheerful, nearly always smiling. He once said to me, 'May I trouble you for the salt, sir?' in such a kind way that it was far better than wit. But I don't remember him making downright jokes. Perhaps I shall save my good things when they happen for you and Sophie." They walked along in silence, Stephen regretting his unkind words, his remorse much increased by the mildness of the response. He saw an unmistakable Philippine pelican overhead, but fearing that he might be even more of a bore with his birds than Jack with his puns, clenches and set pieces, he didn't point it out. Besides, his head was about to split.
"But tell me," he said at last, What did you mean by St. Famine's Day? Here we have a boar of 80 and a 200-weight turtle. Yes, it is charming. A little over £1 a head for 2 days, and that'd be high living if there were ship's bread or even dried peas to go with it. But there ain't. I blame myself very much for not rousing out more biscuit, flour, salt beef and pork while there was yet time. Dear Jack, you couldn't foretell the typhoon. And the boats never ceased going to and fro. Yes, but it was the envoy's things that went first, and his followers. Killick, God forgive him, privately shipped the silver in your skiff. It should have been dried peas. First things first, for as you said yourself, the hogs are hardly to be found now, nor even the apes. We're 6 upon 4 already. There are almost no coconuts left, and fishing reduces almost nothing safe to eat, and all that to one side. It's amazing how little food you absolutely need. You can keep going and work hard on old boots, leather belts, and the most unlikely things if you're in spirits. No, when I speak of St. Famine's Day, I mean the day when I have to tell them there's no more tobacco and no more grog. You cannot believe how they hold to those two things, and that'll be in less than a fortnight. Would you expect a mutiny? Mutiny in the sense of outright revolt and refusal of command? No. But from some of the people I expect muttering, discontent, ill will. And nothing makes work slower or more inefficient or more unsafe than ill will and its perpetual quarrels. It's horrible having to drive even half a resentful, sullen crew. Then again, whenever a king's ship is lost, there are always a few clever fellows who tell the rest that since the officers are commissioned to a particular ship, they have no authority once that particular ship is gone. They also say the seaman's pay stops on the day of the wreck, so no service or obedience is due. The articles of war no longer apply. Are these things true? Lord, no. They were once upon a time, but that was knocked on the head after the loss of the wager in Anson's day. Still, a good many of the hands are quite willing to believe they're going to be done in the eye again. The service has a shocking reputation where pay and pensions are concerned. At this point, the level strand was broken by the bank of debris brought down by the torrential rain. They climbed it, and there below in the natural slip lay the schooner, as neat an anatomy of a vessel as could be wished. "There!" cried Jack. "Ain't you amazed?" "Extremely so," said Stephen, closing his eyes. "I thought you would be," said Jack, nodding and smiling. "It must be 2 or even 3 days since you saw her, and since then we've reached not only the fashion pieces but the transoms and ribbons. There are only the counters, and then we start planking."
"The counters, indeed?"
"Yes. Let me explain. You see the sternpost, of course. The fashion pieces rise on either side, and then curving out from them you see the counter timbers." Jack Aubrey spoke with great animation. He and Mr. Hadley the carpenter were particularly proud of this elegant stern, but his enthusiasm led him to go on rather long, and in too great detail about the rabbits and the cant frames. Stephen was obliged to interrupt him. "Forgive me, Jack," he said. And turning aside, he was extremely sick. Few things could have been more disconcerting. Dr. Maturin, no mere surgeon but a physician, possessed a perfect command of health, other people's and, of course, his own. Disease had no hold on him. He'd undergone Antarctic cold and equatorial heat with equal immunity. He'd nursed a whole ship's company through a murderous outbreak of jail fever quite unscathed. He treated yellow fever, plague and smallpox as fearlessly as the common cold. And here he was, as pale as an ostrich egg. Jack led him gently up the hill. "It's only a passing fit," said Stephen. And then, as they approached the earthwork, "I believe I shall sit here and get my breath again." This he did, in the corner of the camp where the gunner
and one of his mates were turning a meagre sand castle of gunpowder on a piece of sailcloth. "Well, Mr. White," he said, "how are you coming along?" Both gunner and mate stopped their work, turned towards him, leaning on their wooden shovels, and shook their heads.
"Well, sir," said White, in his usual shattering roar, "I boiled out the peter from the ruined barrels, like I said, and it crystallised and mixed and ground down quite pretty with a little old piss, as we say. But will it dry in this cruel wet air? No, sir, it will not, not even in the sun, not even if we turn it ever so."
"I think we shall have a wind in the east tomorrow, Master Gunner," said Jack, so quietly that the gunner stared. "Then you'll have no trouble." He took Stephen's elbow, heaved him up, led him to their tent, and sent a boy running for Macmillan, the assistant surgeon.
"The doctor looked wholly pale,"
said the gunner, staring still. He was looking paler by far when Macmillan arrived. The young man was fond of his chief, but even after so long a voyage in such very close proximity, he was still in great awe of him. And now he was sadly at a loss. Having made the usual gestures, tongue, pulse, and so on, he said very diffidently, "May I suggest 20 drops of the alcoholic tincture of opium, sir?"
"No, sir, you may not,"
cried Stephen with surprising vehemence. He had been very deeply addicted to the drug for years and years, reaching such monstrous doses that they hardly bear repetition, and suffering in due proportion when he gave it up. "But," he added, when the pain of his own cry had died away, "as you will have perceived, there is an increasing febrility, and our best course is no doubt bark, steel, saline enemata, rest, and above all quiet. True quietness, as you know very well, is not to be expected in a camp full of sailors, but balls of wax provide something not unlike it. They are behind the balm of Gilead." When Macmillan came back with all these things, Stephen said to him, "There will, of course, be no true physical effect for some time. And in the meanwhile, it is possible that I shall grow light-headed. I'm aware of a rapid increase in the fever, and already there is a slight inclination to wandering fancies, disconnected thoughts, hallucination, the first hint of delirium. Be so good as to pass me 3 coca leaves from the box in my breeches pocket, and sit as comfortably as you can on the folded sail." Having chewed the leaves for some time, he went on, "One of the miseries of medical life is that on the one hand you know what shocking things can happen to the human body, and on the other you know how very little we can really do about most of them. You are therefore denied the comfort of faith. Many and many a time have we seen patients in real distress declare themselves much relieved after a draught of some nauseous but wholly neutral liquid, or a sugared pill of common flour. This cannot or should not happen with us." Each retired into his memory, recalling cases where, in fact, it had happened. Sometimes, perhaps, in his own person. And presently, Stephen said, "But I'll tell you another misery that's not to be denied. In the common natural course of events, physicians, surgeons and apothecaries are faced with enormous demands for sympathy. They may come into immediate contact with 6 deeply distressing cases in a single day. Those who are not saints are in danger of running out of funds and becoming bankrupt, a state which deprives them of a great deal of their humanity. If the man is in private practice, he's obliged to utter more or less appropriate words to preserve his connection, his living. And the mere adoption of a compassionate face, as you've no doubt observed, goes some little way towards producing at least the ghost of pity. But our patients cannot leave us. They've no alternative. We're not required to put on a conciliating expression, for our inhumanity in no way affects our livelihood. We have a monopoly. And I believe that many of us pay a very ugly price for it in the long run. You must already have met a number of callous, idle, self-important, self-indulgent, hard-hearted, pragmatic brutes, wherever the patients have no free choice. And if you remain in the Navy, you'll meet a great many more. Monopoly had not yet turned Macmillan into a pragmatic brute, however. He and Ahmed sat all that stifling, humid night at Stephen's side, fanning him, giving him water from the cool depths of the well and rocking his hammock with an even motion. Before sunrise, the promised east wind began to steal in across the sea, bringing coolness with it, and they had the satisfaction of seeing him lapse into a quiet, untroubled sleep. "I believe Surrey may do very well," said Macmillan, when Jack beckoned him out of the tent. The fever fell as suddenly as it rose with a profuse, laudable sudation. "And if he lie quiet today, taking a little broth from time to time, he may get up tomorrow." Stephen was mistaken in supposing that quietness was not to be had in a camp full of sailors. While stars were still in the sky, they tiptoed off in a silent body, carrying their meagre breakfast to eat at the slip, leaving only a few men whose work made almost no noise at all. The rope-making party with their junk, yarns and wheel, the gunner ready to spread his powder as soon as the sun should give him some hope of drying it, the sailmaker who had reached the schooner's jibs, and Killick, who intended to overhaul the doctor's wardrobe. Ahmed was no hand with a needle. And glorious task, to polish the entirety of the captain's silver. It was into a strange, unnatural stillness, therefore, that Stephen stepped out of the tent a little before noon. Macmillan had gone to the galley to see about broth in due course. Ahmed had left much earlier in search of fresh young coconuts. And Stephen, feeling quite well, though absurdly weak, had to go to the necessary house.
"I hope I see you well, sir," said the gunner in a hoarse whisper.
"Very much better, I thank you, Mr. White," said Stephen. "And you should be happy with this fine dry breeze." In a somewhat grudging tone, the gunner said that in a couple of days he might be able to barrel it up. And then, louder and with much more conviction, "But you never ought to have got up walking about in your nightshirt with an east wind blowing. If you'd given me a hail, I should have made that idle lobcock Killick bring a utensil." The gunner, like Dr. Maturin himself, was a warrant officer, and although he was not of wardroom rank, he was entitled to express his opinion. The rope makers were not. But Stephen met with so many disapproving looks and shaken heads as he went down and then up the rope walk that he was quite glad to be back in the tent. Macmillan brought him a bowl of Barbarossa soup, thickened with pounded biscuit, turtle being thought too rich, congratulated him on his recovery, pointed out with a shade of reproach that there was a close stool in the far corner, and said that as Ahmed was sure to be back any minute, he was only going to the West Point, while Killick was now within earshot, he meant to take a little sleep. And with deference, he suggested that the doctor should do the same. This the doctor did, in spite of a distant roar of merriment down by the slip at noon, where the Barbarossa turned on its spit before a noble driftwood fire. And he didn't wake until he heard first Malayan voices that he didn't recognise, and then Killick saying,
"How, mate? Tell him there's plenty more in the other chest. I could have spread out twice as much if I had more room."
Ahmed translated this, adding that Captain Aubrey was very enormously rich, very enormously important, a kind of Raja in his own country, And then, answering a curiously high-pitched voice, a eunuch's, a boy's, he explained what the gunner was doing with the powder and why. There were several other voices, English and muted, for although Ahmed had repeatedly been told he's much better, mate, walk to the head like a fairy, he had as often been told, but he's asleep now, so you want to talk low. The high-pitched voice, however, felt no need at all to talk low. It questioned Ahmed closely, insistently, about the gunpowder. Was that all? Was it ready? When would it be ready? Would it be good? Eventually, Stephen slipped out of his hammock, put on his shirt and breeches, and walked out. The high-pitched voice at once fell into the natural pattern of things. It belonged to a slim young woman, well, youngish, whom he took to be a Dyak, from her handsome, animated face and her fine complexion. She wore a long, tight skirt that gave her the swaying, willowy gait of a Chinese woman with bound feet, and a little jacket that didn't conceal her bosom, nor was it intended to conceal her bosom. To the sailor's delight, it often fluttered open in the capricious, strengthening breeze. She had an ivory-hilted crease thrust into her waistband, and her second incisors, not the middle ones, were filed to a point, so that she appeared to have two pairs of dog teeth. Perhaps, reflected Stephen, it was this that made her expression so remarkably vicious. It didn't deter the seamen and the few marines remaining in the camp, however. They gathered about her, gazing like a herd of moon calves. And the gunner, though he didn't quite abandon his heap, now so powdery as to be almost ready, was particularly eager to satisfy her curiosity. Stephen greeted the newcomers, and the young woman and her grey-headed companion replied with all the formal civility usual among those who speak Malay, but in an accent and with some variations he'd never heard before. Ahmed stepped forward with his explanation. When he reached the West Point in his vain search for coconuts, he found them landing from a small proa with five companions. They asked him what he was about, and when he explained the situation, they gave him these coconuts, pointing to a little net. The tide was on the ebb, and together with the current it made such a rip that the proa couldn't have come up the coast even with the most favourable breeze, so he'd brought these two by the middle path. "How did you walk in that skirt?" asked Stephen in English, a quick aside. "She took it off," said Ahmed, blushing. "I admire your crease," said Stephen to her. "Never was a hilt made for so small and delicate a hand." "Give me your honoured forearm," said the young woman with her startling smile. And drawing her crease, a straight-bladed damascened crease, she shaved a stretch as bare and smooth as any barber could have done. "Tell it to do me," cried the gunner, starting forward. And as he left the sailcloth, so the east wind took it, enveloping his mate and scattering the powder far to leeward, an impalpable, irrecoverable cloud of dust. "Look what you made me do, Tom Evans, you infernal lobcock!" roared Mr. White. "Ahmed," said Stephen, "a coffee in the tent, if you please. A silver pot, four cups, and a cushion for the young lady. Preserved Kinnick, run down as fast as ever you can, and tell the captain with my compliments that there are two sea dyaks here." "I leave my silver, and with my poor leg," cried Kinnick, sweeping his arm round the improbable array all blazing in the sun. "Oh, so let young Achilles go. He can run faster than any man in the fleet." "Very well. Pray cut along, Achilles. You'll never forget my compliments, sure." And as Achilles leapt the breastwork and hared down the slope, he continued, "Do not you trust your shipmates, Killick?" "No, sir," said Killick, "nor these strangers. I don't like to say anything against a lady, but when they first came, they called out, 'Hey there,' in their own language, and looked very wishful. God love us, how they stared at the soup tureens." They looked wishful still as they walked past the display, but having exchanged a couple of words in a language that was not Malay, They averted their eyes and passed on into the tent. The grey-haired man was obviously the woman's inferior. He sat on the ground at a distance, and although what he said was urbane enough in the Malayan way, it was nothing like so urbane, nor nearly as copious as her conversation. A steady, lively flow, not of anything so coarse as direct inquiry, but of remarks that would have elicited information if Stephen had chosen to give it. He didn't choose, of course. After so long a course of discretion, his mind would scarcely agree to give the exact time without an effort. But obvious unwillingness to speak was quite as indiscreet as blabbing, and he now replied with what she must already know, replied at such length that he was still prosing away about the advantages and disadvantages of a warm climate, when Jack came in, redder in the face than usual, having pounded up the hill in Achilles' wake. Stephen made the introductions with all proper formality. Killick furtively covered the close stool with the blue peter upon which Jack Aubrey sat. The coffee appeared, and Stephen said, "The captain does not understand Malay, so you will forgive me if I speak to him in English. Nothing would give us greater pleasure than to hear the English language," said the young woman. "I am told it is very like that of birds." Stephen bowed and said, "Jack, first may I beg you not to gaze upon the young woman with such evident lubricity. It is not only uncivil, but it puts you at a moral disadvantage. Secondly, shall I ask these people will they carry a message to Batavia for a fee, and if so, what shall the message be?" There was a look of respectful admiration. "And who's calling the kettle black anyway? But I'll turn my eyes elsewhere in case it should be misunderstood." Jack drank coffee to give himself a countenance, and then went on, "Yes, do please ask whether they will go to Batavia for us. With this leading wind set in so steady, it shouldn't take them above a couple of days. As for what the message should be, let me think while you settle the first essential point." Stephen raised the question, and he listened attentively to the long, well-considered, temporising reply, reflecting as he did so that here was a more spirited, articulate mind than any he'd met in Pulau Prabang, except when he was talking to Wan Da, whose mother was a Dayak. When she'd finished, he turned to Jack and said, "In short, everything depends on the fee. Her uncle, a man of the first consequence in Putianak and the skipper of the proa, particularly wish to be home for the Skull Festival. It would be a great sacrifice for him, for the rest of the crew, and for the lady herself to give up the Skull Festival. And even with this prosperous wind, it must take 2 days to reach Batavia." The discussion resumed with considerations on regular feasts in various parts of the world and on the Skull Festival in particular. It approached the area of compensations and of hypothetical sums and means of payment. And while coffee was being poured out again, Stephen said, "Jack, I believe we shall come to an understanding presently, and perhaps it might save time if you were to prepare a list of things you would like Mr. Raffles to send, for I presume you don't mean to abandon the schooner, and she almost ready to swim." "God forbid," said Jack, "that would be flying in the face of Providence indeed. No, I shall just jot down a few essentials that he can send in the first fishing boat that comes to hand. No hanging about for Indiamen or anything of that kind." He began 100 weight of tobacco, 20 gallons of rum, or arrack if rum is not to be had, and he'd reached 112 pound and 59 pound round shot, 2 half-barrels of red large grain and 1 of red fine grain, when Stephen said to him, "We are agreed on a fee of 20 johannes. 20 joes? Cried Jack. "Well, it's a great deal, sure, but it's the smallest of Shao Yen's notes that I possess, and I don't wish to lead the young woman into temptation." He saw a smile forming and a premonitory gleam in Captain Aubrey's eye, and he said, "Jack, at this stage, I implore you not to be witty. The lady is as fine as amber, has a very penetrating mind, and mustn't be offended. I don't wish to lead her into temptation, I say, by giving her coin which Satan might urge her to run away with. These Johannes she can receive only when she has given Shao Yan your note and his own countersigned by me. She's perfectly acquainted with his seal. So if your list is ready, pray let me have it, and we'll put up the two together. Furthermore, the lady, whose name is Kesegaran, no remarks, Jack, if you please, a modest downward look, no more, states that she would be very happy to see the schooner, and since the wind, adverse for her uncle's proa, is favourable for our boat, we might gain an hour or two by wafting her down to the southern point. Besides, civility requires no less." They stood watching the cutter stand out to sea. Again a handsome offing, put about, and skimmed down towards the southern point over a fine, lively sea, light blue, flecked with white. All hands were sitting there with naval correctness. The only incongruities were Seymour's lack of uniform and Kesegaran's way of hitching herself from the stern sheets to the windward gunwale and perching there, riding the seas in the most natural way in the world. "I've never seen any woman take such an intelligent interest in shipbuilding," said Jack. "Nor in the shipbuilder's tools," said Stephen. Both she and her companion fairly groaned with desire. "They may have coveted your silver, and I'm sure they did, but that was a mere passing velleity compared with their yearning for Mr. Hadley's double-handed saws, adzes, jackscrews, and many other bright steel objects I cannot name. In some parts they have to sew their planks together," observed Jack. But Stephen, following his own thoughts, said, "When I spoke of a vicious expression, I didn't mean vicious in any moral sense. In fact, I shouldn't have used the word at all. What I meant was fierce and savage, or rather potentially fierce and savage, certainly not to be trifled with. I cannot imagine any man trifling with Kesegaran, who valued his... that's to say, who didn't wish to end his days as a gelding. Have you ever seen a mink, brother?" asked Stephen after some moments. With an inward sigh, Jack abandoned a play on the words mink, minks, minxes, and said he'd not, but believed they were something in the line of marten cats, though smaller. "Yes, yes," cried Stephen, "the marten is a much better figure. A very handsome creature indeed, but in attacking its prey or in defending itself of the most extreme ferocity. That was the improper sense I gave to vicious." A pause. "Suppose they reach Batavia by Wednesday afternoon," said Jack. "Do you think it would take long for them to reach your banker and for the banker to reach Raffles?" "My dear, I have no more knowledge of their feasts and holidays than you, nor of their state of health. But Shao Yan is very well with the governor and could send him your message in 5 minutes if he's there. The governor is wholly favourable to us, and within another 5 minutes he could lay his hand on some ship, boat or vessel. You've seen Batavia Roads and Maritime Hyde Park Corner." "Then, in the best of cases, providing he hits on a windward craft, and after all he was born at sea, even with this breeze we could begin hoping to see them on Sunday. New Manila cordage, fresh 6-inch spikes, pots of paint, to say nothing of the essential powder and shot, rum and tobacco. Long live Sunday!" "Long live Sunday," said Stephen, creeping off up the hill. "And long live Sunday," he repeated, swinging in his hammock and trying to find sound reasons for the feeling of extreme dissatisfaction at the back of his mind. His calling led him to be intensely suspicious, and he acknowledged that he often went much too far, particularly when he wasn't well. Yet why had Kesegaran told Ahmed to bring them to the camp by the middle path? The quite arduous middle path, rather than by the strand. It was clear that she knew the island fairly well, although she'd observed in passing, and quite truly, no doubt, that because of its dangerous currents it was little frequented. The middle path meant that she had seen the camp in all its nakedness, and the poor, simple half-wit Ahmed had made the nakedness more apparent still by telling her about the powder. The chance meeting, the circumstances in which the camp was seen, could hardly have been more unfortunate. But, on the other hand, down by the slip she'd seen 100 powerful men and more, no negligible force at all. And the fact of having one's second incisors filed to a point, no doubt a tribal custom, didn't necessarily argue any very great depravity of mind.